Hey, what's up? John Doherty here for Radio Tacoma's Climate Talk. You may have noticed that the World Meteorological Organization just announced that there's a 66% chance that we're going to exceed that 1.5 degrees centigrade Earth warming boundary by 2027. Short version, we're not doing anywhere near well enough in efforts to address human-caused global warming by simply reducing emissions. Add to that the fact that the CO2 we've put out there is going to be there for hundreds to thousands of years, continuing to warm the Earth. One of the possible steps we could take to address both problems is to remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, and that's going to be the focus today of my conversation with Dr. Hanna Brunig, who is a research scientist with the Lawrence Berkeley National Labs. Full disclosure, I come into this conversation skeptical of carbon dioxide removal schemes for a number of reasons, including the massive scope we're talking about, as well as the costs and the political feasibility. Add to that my worry that the fossil fuel industry and the public in general might just conclude that, well, we can just continue to pump greenhouse gases into the atmosphere and use technology to pull it out. I know from earlier conversations with Dr. Brunig that her team's research shows us a path forward through these potential objections. So let's listen in and see what she has to say. Dr. Hanna Brunig from Lawrence Berkeley National Labs, welcome to Climate Talk.
Nice to be here. Thanks.
Appreciate you taking the time. And so, Lawrence, let's start off with you. Tell me a little bit about what it is you do. And then when we do that, when we've got that done, we'll talk a little bit about Lawrence Berkeley National Labs and what the big picture is there.
Sure. So I'm a research scientist at Lawrence Berkeley National Lab in the energy technologies area. I have a group of researchers that work with me on understanding the potential of energy and water technologies to make an impact. So my group specifically looks at helping to predict how a technology being developed in the lab might ultimately perform once it's in the market. So we try to understand not only cost and economics of a technology that's very new, but understand the impacts on the environment, the climate, and communities.
Well, that sounds far-reaching. In fact, it's a wider cast net than I realized you guys did down there. So looking forward to digging into that. So a little bit about Lawrence Berkeley National Labs. I mean, how it came into being, where it is, where the money comes from, and what its big picture purpose is.
Yeah, so Lawrence Berkeley National Lab, or we can shorten it to just LBNL, is one of 17 national labs that are the gems of the Department of Energy, as they often call them. They're academic institutions. Some of them are operated and owned by the government. Other ones are operated by other institutions. For LBNL, we are operated by the University of California, Berkeley. And if you've ever been there, Berkeley is right down the hill from where our laboratory is. And our lab in particular is really known for understanding and developing breakthroughs in science, specifically ones with big impact. So we're the national lab that's known for discovering new elements. We're also the national lab that's known for understanding the way climate is affecting the changing ice. We're also known for being a leader in a number of technologies that are critical for energy efficiency and for improving how we get our services from technology without consuming a lot of materials or energy. So one of the founding fathers out of our area is Art Rosenfeld. And he's nicknamed the father of energy efficiency for good reason, because he was one of the first people to say, hey, we can just use things smarter and we don't have to make any major changes. We don't have to suffer. We can just be not so wasteful and look at the potential that that can have. So that's really the kind of stance that we look at when we go forward with our research.
So I want to just ask you a bit of a personal question here for a second that just occurs to me. So you're a scientist, you're a research scientist, and let's just say in terms of what's going on in the physical and chemical world, you probably have a pretty good handle on that. I'm just saying. So how does it feel to have a good handle on what's going on with the physics and chemistry of the climate in particular, and then see what's going on politically, culturally, policy-wise? How does that feel?
Yeah, I've had a kind of a full circle reflection on that in particular. We are very off track in terms of making the changes we need. It's well understood, it's well documented, the amount of change we need to make versus what's actually being captured even in proposed climate policies are so mismatched. So we are running into a situation where we're now looking at adaptation strategies, not just mitigation strategies. It makes me feel deep concern. However, to be honest, I feel that humans have adapted to changes for all of their existence, and we still have our core values, which is family and community. And ultimately, those things carry me through. I have an 8-year-old son, and I had that son knowing full well all the details of climate change. The things that scare me more are much more about how we treat each other and politics than climate change at this point.
Okay, well, one of the things that I pick up that from your comments there is that scientists are people too. I mean, I've always known that, but it's very easy to think, well, these are just a bunch of folks in lab coats and looking through strange looking instruments and talking to each other in language that nobody else can understand, but except for other scientists. But yeah, it's a real picture into the fact that aside from the work that scientists do, they're real human beings with concerns and hopes and fears and kind of, I guess, hoping for the best for our species, which is sometimes challenging for me these days. So anyway, enough of that. Your areas of interest are so widespread. What I'd like to do today is to just dig into some of the research that you're doing or that you're familiar with on negative emissions technology. And so just give us a 30,000 foot view for starters of what we're talking about when we're talking about negative emissions technology.
Absolutely. So a negative emission technology is quite simply a technology that removes carbon from the atmosphere. So removes it from that part of the carbon cycle. It's not an avoided emission. It's a technology that is removing an emission that already happened. There are a
So,
bunch of different types. Some of them are natural based and some of them are technology based. So natural-based solutions could be just enhancing the processes that already occur on Earth, just helping them along, avoiding degradation or kind of making amends to the degradation that's happened because of human activities. So that could be improving the soil retention of carbon. And then there's the technology-based ones, which are direct interventions such as direct air capture, where you basically have a system that draws carbon dioxide out of the air and captures it in a concentrated form.
So kind of in your opening comments, you indicated to me that you really do pay attention to what I'll call, for a lack of a better term, the big picture around our climate and especially greenhouse gas emissions. And you made the comment that your lab is starting to look at adaptation as well as mitigation, which has got to be a pretty important decision. And there's some implications of why you would have made that decision. So here's my question. Can we create or preserve a livable future without removing carbon from the atmosphere through these kind of technological means you're talking about?
Can we create a livable situation, which I will classify as 1.5 to 2 degrees warming
Okay,
based on the IPCC? That's
yeah.
just a shared definition. Based on technologies for capture, so that's where I kind of lost you because we are saying basically, can we stay within this temperature range without carbon removal technologies, that's I think what you're asking
Yeah,
me, right?
exactly.
Okay,
Exactly.
yeah. And the answer is strongly no at this point. And I can explain why I say that. The recently in March, the IPCC put out their sixth report, and I'm proud to say some of the scientists in our area actually contributed to that report. And the understanding was there's a certain quantity of carbon that needs to be removed from the atmosphere. And to achieve that reduction, we have to take extraordinary measures in removal, something along the lines of reducing, trying to remember what it is, 40% of the carbon emissions from the atmosphere. And comparing that to the goals of the climate policies out today, just on getting away from fossil fuels, reduced energy consumption, we're looking more at something like 7%. So even the mismatch there is very telling. Let's say we were aggressive with our methods for removing the amount of carbon that we have, the emissions, the rate of emissions. We still have historical carbon that we have to deal with that is leading to effects that are irreversible. So by 2050, it's pretty understood that we need to be removing a substantial amount of carbon on the order of 7 gigatons of carbon per year. And so there's a lot of concern that this is a tactic to delay emissions reduction today. That's valid. That's absolutely valid. I don't disagree with that one bit. That's human nature. But to deny ourselves technologies that can help seems ridiculous to me at the same time.
So a lot there. Let's just stop here for a second and take a look at. I'm more interested in talking about the technical solutions versus the natural solutions. So, what are some of the technical solutions that you see as being practical? And by practical, I mean they can be scoped out enough to handle the job, and they can be done economically in an economically feasible kind of way.
Yeah, so I'll speak mostly to the technologies that I've studied. There are
Okay.
many sets of technologies out there. So bioenergy with carbon capture and sequestration, to me, seems to be one of the most promising technologies out there because it's already deployed. It's very mature. There are, of course, types that are earlier stage, but it's understood that there is biomass available that's already out that can be leveraged, that can be used to make energy to reduce our use of fossil fuels. So that's an avoidance of emissions. And then you capture the carbon dioxide coming out of that and you sequester it. And now you have a negative emission energy and technology. So that by far is one that is deployable. It's going to be limited based on the biomass available. I'm not necessarily a proponent of growing biomass for the sole purpose of bioenergy with carbon capture, but I have looked at with teams at Berkeley, including PI Corinne Skoun, technologies for using waste biomass, landfill gases, and crop waste and forestry waste that's just sitting as forest fire. So that one makes so much sense to me. The next one that makes a lot of sense to me is direct air capture. So there are some key challenges that come with that. Basically, what it is, you have a fan blows air through. You have a contactor that is exposed to with a material that has been designed to have a very high attraction or affinity for CO2, which is hard because when you think about the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere, that's 400 parts per million. That's very dilute. So you need to design a material that really likes carbon dioxide. So the problem with that is now to recover your carbon dioxide, you just designed a material that loves it. So you have to use energy to heat it or to pressurize it or to force it off. And that's where we run into problems with DAC or direct air capture. We haven't fully figured that piece out yet, but the Department of Energy is dumping so much money into early stage research on this topic alone. I'm convinced that we will have solutions within the next 5 years. And the beauty of DAC is that it is independent of geography. It can be placed practically anywhere that's located near a sink for the carbon dioxide. So unlike bioenergy with carbon capture, it's not limited by a resource per se.
Okay, so that's two big ones that I'm just layperson familiar with. So a couple questions on that. So you mentioned a sink for director capture. Well, let me just stop before I go there, though. I just want to repeat back to you in my layperson perspective what you're talking about. So carbon capture and storage, the way I understand it, typically is capturing carbon from sources like flues of coal-fired electric generating plants or something like that. Do I have that right?
That's CCUS. So carbon capture, utilization, and sequestration is capturing CO2 with high concentrations of CO2 in those
Okay.
waste gases versus direct air capture, which is capturing from ambient air or from ocean water.
Okay, got it. So, direct air capture, you mentioned a sink. So I think one of the interesting things is, maybe one of the critical things is, what happens to the carbon after it's captured?
Yeah, so I wrote a paper about this. This is
Okay.
something that means a lot to me because I actually see this as a underappreciated challenge. We have a lot of folks in our earth science department and elsewhere looking at geologic large-scale sequestration and storage of CO2 underground. So that's your sink. That's a very permanent sink. There are measurement and verification methods to confirm that storage. However, when you look at the way the oil and gas field has explored and developed these mines for injection for oil and gas or extraction, just the rate at which that is happening. So the potential number of these geologic sites we could get up and running in the next 15 years mismatches with the amount of CO2 we need to draw down from the air. So that is that source and sources being like the capture of CO2, whether it's from flue gas or air, and the storage are mismatched. And that's something that I study.
So, what's the solution to that?
We haven't figured it out yet.
Okay.
The solution, the good news solution is that we are still in the pilot stage for the CO2 capture sites. We're just now getting past the 10,000 tons per year capture, ambitiously aiming for 1 million or more tons per year at one facility. So really, these facilities are absolutely tiny and compared to the storage available. So they're being strategically located next to active sequestration sites. So in the near term, all these projects you hear about maybe on Twitter and the news, they have their sinks. But for rapidly scaling it up or for having solutions for somewhere that's not located near that, we don't have near-term ready solutions. So that's what I study is there any way to temporarily store the CO2 in a stable, safe form until those large-scale geologic sites come up? So this is early stage research. There are a number of materials that you can store CO2 in, but that still needs further work to really understand the cost of that.
Yeah, this brings up kind of a interesting side point in terms of public perception of science, because I hear people complaining about a couple of things. One is science changing its mind, and the other is that science not knowing answers. And so we just bumped into both of those. And I just want to make the point for those folks that that's an asset, not a liability. You know, science changes its mind, and you can correct me on this. Science changes its mind, if there is such a thing, when the evidence shows that it's time to change minds, as opposed to, let's say, maybe political ideology, where people can hang on to a particular point of view forever and not ever have to change their minds. And science is, once again, correct me if I'm wrong here, but it seems like science is always working on the leading edge of something where they're constantly saying, well, we don't know the answer to this. We're looking for it. And when we find this answer, we're going to be moving on to the next question.
Well, if I could give one perspective on that, then this came out of something I read recently that really struck me. It said, don't talk about science being right or wrong, or don't talk about believing science, talk about the scientific method. And I absolutely agree with that statement. Science has changed, throughout the course of human history, our understanding of things. That's always true. In fact, there was a whole piece about the fact that it's been white males who have done science that has led to data pool that has been incorrect for many other populations when applied extra. So I fully believe that science is going to be changing. Our understanding of things is going to be evolving. That's the point. But the scientific method holds strong. So that's, if anything, critical thinking is more important than anything right now. And science should be taken as a set of data that we make conclusions from and not ultimatums.
One of the things that I see is that unfortunately in our general population, first comes a worldview, then comes conclusions, as opposed to going out and examining the world and then from an unbiased perspective and then coming to a conclusion. But that's just a problem for which we're it's something that's going to be true about us as a species for a long time, I think. So let's
Yeah,
talk
and I
about.
don't have all the answers either. I mean, my 8-year-old tells me, like he knows what I do. He calls me a doctor for the planet.
Oh,
And
nice.
he asks me, the planet's sick. Like, I think it makes him genuinely sad. And I don't have an answer for him because, like we started this whole talk, I'm doing this work because I believe that there's going to be marginal benefit, hopefully a big breakthrough. But there needs to be a lot more in place for us to have radical change and reduce climate change. And that's outside of, my own research. But I see the value in my research and I feel like it's going in the right direction.
Yeah, I think one of the core things about us as human beings is we do have to feel like what we're doing has got meaning and it's got the possibility of making a difference. And that's basically why I'm here talking to you today, too. So we certainly share that perspective. So let's talk about money for a second. So the technologies you're talking about, is there any way those technologies can become self-supporting financially, i.e., they will not have to be subsidized by the taxpayers?
That's a really good question. And that is the goal. The Department of Energy put out a Earthshot. So basically, the moonshot, And so now we have Earthshots. And the Earthshot is to get carbon capture to $100 per ton of carbon dioxide with the understanding that that would make it financially viable and rapidly scale it up. So that is the understanding that it would be then cost effective to achieve large scales that are meaningful. Right now, we are finding, let's say, lab stage technologies that could potentially hit that target. That's what my team does, is predict that. So there's some exciting news there that we have some solutions on hand. However, without subsidy, we don't have market deployed technologies out yet. I am a in strong favor of carbon taxes. They make sense to me, and it would be in a world with a carbon tax where you're seeing any of these changes really happening. Without the carbon tax, I am very doubtful that there will be much change in the United States.
Yeah, well, I share your valuing a carbon tax. And for those who are listening right now who are kind of anti-subsidy, I just want to make the point that we really are subsidizing the fossil fuel industry already in terms of allowing that industry and its customers to dump their pollution into the environment, which is putting a cost on the environment, it's putting a cost on people's health and so forth. And those are not insignificant costs. I mean, they're relatively measurable and they're very large costs. So a carbon tax would be one step towards addressing that disparity, as well as providing the funding for the kind of thing that you're talking about. I'm going to do a quote here from the National Academies, and the big picture question I'm going to have is, how do we keep negative emission technologies from just being used as an excuse to continue producing greenhouse gases. So here's the quote. Most climate mitigation technologies are intended to decrease the rate at which we take additional carbon from fossil fuel reservoirs and ecosystems and add it to the atmosphere as CO2. So what I'm wondering is the marketplace is the marketplace, and oil companies are going to sell their oil as profitably as they can, as for long as they can, is my guess. And so what is there any kind of mechanism that would keep these technologies from just being an excuse to produce more greenhouse gases?
I mean, economics alone is a good mechanism. The what they're talking about, climate mitigation technologies, is not just nets that we've been talking about. It's also capture of CO2 at existing facilities, more energy efficient technologies that are more fuel efficient. Those are by and far proving to be cheaper than nets. And so that alone is going to be a decision making point here. It's the companies that have really aggressive targets for zero or neutrality or actually scrubbing historical emissions. They're the ones who are going to be purchasing these CO2 captured from nets. So that's where I think the market is really defining itself. So companies that just need to meet their targets, reduce their emissions incrementally year by year, they're going to see the writing on the wall. They're going to invest in the more efficient energy system, the more efficient boiler, switch from coal to natural gas. They're going to make those investments now. But actually, moving to carbon negative technologies, that's, I think, going to be left for the mega companies like Microsoft, like Stripe, who are already saying we want to purchase bulk amounts of CO2 because we want to be a front runner, a leader in our carbon emissions reductions. So that's where I see a real difference happening.
Yeah, and that does seem like a critical part of the whole piece, if we're going to be successful with those technologies. So we're getting close to the end here, but I just want to ask you, there are a couple of other technologies that I hear batted around, and I'm wondering if you guys look at those at all. One of them is like putting sulfur dioxide, I think it is, in the atmosphere to kind of create an artificial haze. And another one that I hear about is the idea of putting these huge mirrors out in space to kind of shade the Earth. So do you guys look at either one of those?
Those are more like geoengineering
Okay.
systems, and Berkeley Lab, not that I'm aware of, is getting grants to work on that kind of stuff. We very well might be the type of lab that would do a broad perspective analysis of what would the risks of that be, what would the cost of that be, but not to my knowledge, we're working on geoengineering. Yeah.
Well, we'll just stay tuned on that one then for another conversation in case that does show up down there. So, I really appreciate you being with me today, Anna, and I know the listeners have got a lot of value from what you've got to offer here. Anything else that you'd like to throw out to us before we finish up?
I just appreciate so much that the community is aware that technologies can play a role and that they want to just learn more. And if anything, I could say, I think scientists have failed at being good at communicating their science. And that's a spot that I would say my generation and generations younger than me are very focused on building our skills in. It's something that we are aware of and we understand it. And I think it's led to a lot of problems and a lot of reluctance towards things like hydrogen or electric vehicles. And it's left a lot of people out of conversations and out of rooms where they should have been at the beginning. And so I can just say that's the way I conduct my research, and I'm really encouraged that I see a shift in that.
Yeah, well, in terms of your communication, you've been effective with me here today because I will tell you that my layperson perspective was that these technologies are just an excuse to pollute more. And you've nudged me more in the direction of like, well, no, that's not exactly true. Plus, we probably got to do it. So your communication effort with me at least has worked very well today. So once again, Dr. Anna Brunig, thanks so much for being with us and best wishes in your projects as they continue forward.
Nice to talk to you, John. Thank you.
Many thanks to Dr. Brunig for sharing what her team's research is showing about using technology to remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. We only touched on a couple specific technology, but those are significant. I find that my mind has changed listening to the probabilities her research is pointing to. Primary amongst those is the reality that we are not going to limit global warming to that 1.5 to 2 degrees area that science points to as an important limit just by reducing or eliminating greenhouse gas emissions. Also, a message for me and perhaps for you, the importance of keeping an inquiring mind as we think about the challenges of climate change. You can contact me at john@ccltacoma.org for comments on this program or to make suggestions for future programs. This program, along with all other locally produced Radio Tacoma programs, can be found on the KTAH website under programming. In the meantime, always live like the mountain is out. Take care now.